Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How do the world's marine mammals behave when they are in their natural environments? Just a few decades ago, scientists had to limit their observations largely to, pardon the pun, fluke sightings in the places these animals were known to frequent, sightings on the surface. But advances in the technology and the techniques of underwater photography have allowed researchers to expand their knowledge of how whales, dolphins, and even the elusive narwhal live, breed, and socialize. And a lot of those researchers credit Charles Flip Nicklin with providing them unique and remarkable images of marine mammal existence beneath the surface. Many of the photographs also happen to be stunningly beautiful so that they appeal to scientists and art lovers simultaneously. Charles Flip Nicklin is lead whale photographer and marine mammal specialist for the National Geographic Society. His new book is called Among Giants, A Life with Whales. Flip, welcome to Think.
Thank you.
You write at the very beginning of the book that the day your father rode a whale changed everything. Can you tell us about that?
Well, certainly. My dad, we had a small dive shop. My dad had just inherited an underwater still camera and movie camera. He was going out with friends to dive for lobsters. They found a whale. We saw whales, but they always moved away, moved by. This whale was stopped. It was a Brutus whale, and its tail was caught in the anchor line of a gill net. He swam around the whale, photographed the whale, took film of the whale, and then got up and sat on the whale and had a picture taken. That picture was published across the country. He also had film, and that was shown locally, and eventually there was a celebrity game show called To Tell the Truth. They invited him to New York. He was on that show, and Bates Littlehales from National Geographic saw him. He was looking for whale experts. My dad was a whale expert. He'd seen one.
Yeah, what's remarkable about that story was at the time, so little was known about these animals that your dad couldn't even be sure he wouldn't be attacked. Did his instinct to try and help make sense to you even back then when you were a kid?
Oh, I think so, and certainly they were cautious at the beginning. And this was, whales were big animals in the sea. They weren't smart. They weren't living better lives. It was a whole different, it was before Save the Whales. So they were certainly cautious and looked around. They're worried that it was injured. There might be other things around, sharks or something. But at the end, the fact that my father free-dived down and took the line off that whale, which was a hard thing to do, it was certainly good for the whale, and it was great for us.
So your dad ultimately specialized in underwater cinematography, and you work mostly with still photographs. What do you see as the particular benefits of either medium?
Well, I think there's two different things. My father loved features. He worked on The Deep and The Abyss and films like that, James Bond films, often with big crews. I wanted to be a scientist. I wanted to be a biologist and was told early on with my academic skills I should do something else. This worked out great. I was a diver. I loved the researchers that I was working with, and I could be the one guy with a camera in the small boat or the little camp to tell their story. So it was a great relationship that goes on today.
How long did it take you to think of yourself, and I'm assuming that you do, as a scientist in your own right?
You know, I still have a hard time. I still feel I'm the junior scientist and storyteller because all the people I work with are tops of the field, and I'm just the guy coming along to tell the story. They have very specialized knowledge of what they do, and I have a big general overview that it isn't very deep, but I know who to call to tell me how to get further.
And you really have to at least have a really clear sense of what you're going to look at so that you know when a photograph is going to be something really special, right?
Well, and exactly. And I think going in there, and I always wanted to enlist them as doing our story. I wanted to know what they wanted to see or what they hoped to see, because if I spent a month, they had spent a year or 10 years. So to get their information to work with was critical.
So seafaring life is in your blood in some ways. Tell us about your great-great-grandfather and how he ended up making his way to San Diego.
Well, I think that was great. A couple of years, I've known about him, but because of the Internet, we learn more all the time.
Yeah.
2 years ago, there was a little gray whale in the back bay in San Diego called Diego, and they dredged up a story from my great-great-grandfather from 1887, and he was talking about the demise of gray whales because South Bay in San Diego used to be a breeding lagoon. And this little whale was there, and the problem for the whale, there's so much activity of boats and people. But my grandfather talked about the 1840s when it was hard to take a boat because there were so many whales, it was dangerous to row in the area.
Wow. You know, what's really interesting about that is that as populations start to come back, and this is, you know, a good thing, few would argue that it isn't, but we have to learn once again how to let the humans, who are a huge presence in the ocean, live, coexist peacefully with the whales that are coming back.
Exactly so. I'm back in Washington, D.C. at National Geographic right now, and one of the big themes in exploration was, how will we live with nature? What will our relationship be, and especially with whales that are coming back, like gray whales and humpback whales, what will we share with them? What will we do to let them be successful with us?
You have a really interesting picture, of among many in the book, of Galveston Bay, which a lot of people that are listening to the show have probably visited. And there is there's a dolphin diving, and behind it are these massive sort of oil rig facilities.
Yes, and that was from the early 90s in a story called Dolphins in Crisis. And those issues were being talked about, and what the issues were with pollution, working with Texas A&M there. And I've worked with a number of Texas universities, but A&M is one of the big cetacean study areas around. And looking that they're trying to find out what the issues were. We knew pollution was a problem, but there were so many different possibilities, it was hard to pin it down.
Hmm. And the word cetacean, we should say, just means marine mammal. Is that right?
Yeah, whales and dolphins.
Okay.
Yes.
So you mentioned earlier that your dad had this little dive shop for much of your childhood. But back then, in the 60s, his main clients were not hobbyists or people that were going out for the weekend. These were professionals.
Yes. In the family diving sort of came in the 70s. We had commercial fishermen, military folks, graduate students and scientists from Scripps, And a lot of spear fishermen and abalone and lobster divers, people going out to get dinner.
Hmm.
It was a different kind of diving at the time, and a lot of it was free diving, not scuba diving.
Let's talk about the free diving, because this is a skill that you have which really blows my mind. You are able to go 100 feet down, stay and work and shoot for a minute, and then come back up with no supplemental oxygen.
You know, I used to be very proud of that. At 63, it slows down all the time. And free diving today has gone way beyond what we ever dreamed. People are diving to hundreds of feet and staying for minutes at a time, holding their breath for times we never dreamed of. So I'm going to just call myself a snorkeler from now on.
What does it take, Flip, to build that kind of lung capacity?
Well, you know, a lot of it was, I started when I was so young that probably, like any athlete, I probably have a bigger vital capacity just from doing it so much and so often. But I think the main thing today, and even still being able to dive for pretty good depths, is relaxation. And going down, and you find it's all about relaxing, not being very efficient, just the things of not making any work that you don't have to. How you sort of drift down and drift back, and then I get 20 or 30 seconds to try and make a picture.
It seems, at least for me, like it would be hard if you only had that 20 or 30 seconds to relax, you know, because you've got so many things to think about. I guess you have to do this sometimes multiple times in a row to get what you want.
Well, yeah, and it is. I'll tell you, when you're down there, it's much more survival than fine art. and yet, you get those moments. And there are times today, my wife gets a little concerned, because you get down there and it's so good, even though you're down 50 or 60 or 70 feet, you forget about it because what you're seeing is so exciting. And then you look back and it's a long way up. So we work with safety divers and now to have someone covering us as we're doing that kind of diving.
How's the experience different if you have scuba gear on?
Well, mainly you're dealing with marine mammals who often use bubbles for communication and to make displays.
Yeah.
So to get in with an 80,000-pound animal and blow bubbles at them saying things you don't know what you're saying, just it disturbs the situation. And my perfect situation is in with behavior going on where the animals will tolerate me being there shooting what they normally do.
Mm-hmm.
So anything that I do to distract them from that works against me.
The bubbles almost sound like flashing gang signs in a neighborhood where you don't really know what the neighborhood gang signs are.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. It's exactly what it is. You know, I wish I didn't wear that blue headband. it is going to change. I think the next generation with remote cameras and rebreathers, scuba gear that doesn't have bubbles, are going to see things I never dreamed of. I just hope they have half as much fun as I did.
So how do you get the animals to tolerate you? Are you pretty sure that they're always aware you're there?
Well, oh no, not always. There are situations where we sneak up to do things. But one of those things is the pictures that are in a book like Among Giants. If I go out for 100 days, those pictures come from 4 of those days.
Yeah.
And the first time I did sperm whales, I spent 6 months to get 4 rolls of film. And when I did narwhals the first time, I had no pictures after 3.5 months.
Is that when you fell into the water twice in the same day?
Oh, yeah. I have a picture of the tent with all my underwear hanging out in front that I love. And you learn a lot. The whole thing is everywhere, whether it's learning about Arctic skills or learning the science, that I felt like I was in one graduate course after another. But mainly I was waiting there, looking over the shoulder of the science being done and waiting for those incredible moments. Because usually if you get in the water with whales, you just learn how slow and awkward you are. Occasionally things go on where all the signs are right and the planets are aligned and you can get in with it. But they are rare moments.
You write about an experience where you saw, I guess there was a dead narwhal female and there were two males sort of guarding her body. Can you tell us about that?
And that was the end of that 3.5 months of not getting anything on my first Arctic story. John Ford, who is a killer whale expert and had worked with us with humpbacks, came in. We were trying to work in a place called Milne Inlet with a little breakdown kayaks, paddling around and diving into the kayaks. We'd had no luck. And he said, something strange is happening. There are two subadult males, probably had 7 or 7.5 foot tusks, and they're with a female that was dying and then dead, and group after group of other big males with up to 9 foot plus tusks were coming in and trying to get access to the female. And the two younger animals were fighting them off time and time again. In between, they were waving the tusk around. And, I mean, it's very exciting being in a canvas boat and seeing these big tusks coming up all around you. And my job was almost always to try and get in the water. And finally, it was successful. Finally, I could slip in the water. And it was like going into a fight in a pool hall with all these animals dragging their tusks across each other. One of those young males came up and put his tusk right in front of my chest, just for a beat, but you could feel the little sonic clicks coming out and remind yourself how stupid you were being. But I got a picture, and that was the kind of picture that made it a National Geographic story.
And you have a quote also in the book from your dad, which is, if you get dead, you can't take any more good pictures.
That was one of the things going through my mind.
What is your relationship to fear?
I'm sorry?
What is your relationship to fear when you're working?
My relationship with?
Fear.
Fear. It's a very good safety thing for me. Our motto is when the going gets dangerous, we should go home. and that idea that if it's going to work, it's going to work. And we get into some situations that are exciting. And if you have a big animal bump into you, even if it's a friendly thing, it can really hurt. So you get bumps and bruises going along. But you're dealing with such big animals and such powerful animals. They're all strange dogs. You have to look at them and see whether the signs look like you might get in and it might be a good situation, but you're certainly not going to take one on. And there are a number of times that we've just seen this animal is excited about other stuff and it's not the place for us, and we go somewhere else.
My guest is Charles Flip Nicklin, lead whale photographer and marine mammal specialist for the National Geographic Society. His new book is called Among Giants, A Life with Whales. If you'd like to join our conversation, we'd love to hear from you now. You can call in to 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a self-designed graduate program that allows you the chance to meet the challenges of society. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Charles Flip Nicklin, lead whale photographer and marine mammal specialist for the National Geographic Society. His new book is called Among Giants, A Life with Whales. Join the conversation by calling in to 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Flip, I realize this question could take the rest of the hour to answer, but talk about some of the really important things we didn't know about whales in the mid-70s when your career was taking hold that we do know now.
Oh, I you're actually right. There's so many different things. I think one of the first things for me, for the general public, was that how many different kinds of whales and dolphins and porpoises there are. And there are probably 86. Many of them we've never even seen alive. We've just seen them caught in nets and stuff from deep ocean. And how different the different, not just the different species, but the different cultures of the same species and the different individuals are, that they're just far more interesting than I think we want to make them sort of machine-like, where if you do this, they'll do that. And it depends which one on one day and what the personality is like for that to work out.
Do you have to spend a lot of time observing these creatures before it becomes apparent that they have individual personalities? Or could the average person sort of look at five different, say, humpback whales and see that they're really different?
Well, I think you get the hint of it. And I think certainly the high point of your knowledge on any whale is probably comes the first week.
Mm-hmm.
After that, it all gets confused.
Yeah.
But going in and working with a researcher who spends months or years before I come in, pointing out which animals and which situations to look for, was a tremendous help. Starting in 1996, I actually started funding and participating in a study on humpback whales in Hawaii. And in that area, where I've put in a bunch of time, I feel I have more to contribute, and I'm actually one of the guys that knows. Usually I'm going in with somebody and trying to get them to share what they've learned so that I can get a head start to figure things out.
You've had a long and incredibly productive professional relationship with the marine biologist Jim Darling, and one of the first times that you got together to work, he was on a mission to study whale song. Can you talk about what we know about how whale song is used and what kinds of things it can communicate?
Oh, that's great, and that's the study I support now in Hawaii. And Jim's a great friend and certainly the first person I would call for whale information. When I started, I was doing an IMAX film with my father, and Jim was the main scientist we were covering in Hawaii. And he knew that whales were singing. He'd figured out which whales were singing and could take pictures of their tails to individually ID the animals. And on March 10th, 1979, a whale that we call Frank, because it was the sixth whale of the day, F as in Frank, dove, and when they dive, they leave a little smooth spot on the surface called a footprint.
Mm-hmm.
And Jim looked overboard and could actually see Frank down below, 40 or 50 feet below, and called us over. And that was my first scientific thing, was diving, free diving down under the tail and taking pictures of Frank's genitals. And so we figured out that the singers, it turned out, were males.
Huh.
And that was a big thing. And since we knew that, the first thing everybody assumed this song was a love song to call females. When we went back in the 90s, we started looking to see who comes to the singer, and it's all other males. The females do not come over, though certainly we think singers want to be with females, but they go to them. The females don't come to the singers.
Wow.
And what it looks like, and this is something we're testing right now with a bunch of playback experiments, is that sometimes there'll be 20 or 30 males behind a female. But you have to, it's not a free-for-all. It's more like the Tour de France, where there are three or four maybe champions, but they have affiliates working with them. And that the song may be a coordinating mechanism to get those teams together. And you can, and one of the things I think we've really had fun with recently is looking and seeing sometimes there are half a dozen males behind a female when it's all completely cooperative. They are working together with their champion, their primary escort coming in, and it's not at all a confrontational situation.
That's more than you could say for a lot of college kids headed to the bar to find a cute girl.
Just taking the wingman to another extreme.
What is? I think we've all heard recordings of whale song, but what does it sound like when you are underwater as this stuff is emanating?
Well, the first time I did it, I couldn't believe it, because we could hear it through the boat on the surface.
Mm-hmm.
But it's somewhere around 160 decibels at the source.
Wow.
And especially when I dive down, and this is an animal you are under federal permit, so you have a license to do this. I was sneaking down to take a picture, and I didn't want him to see me before I got in position, so I'm blocking his eyes with his tail as I'm coming in. I dive down under, and it's like being in a kettle drum. It is so loud. Rather than hearing it, it's more like you feel it in your air spaces. And as I move down, and this happened a number of times, actually you'd see the tail start to rise, and I was just sure he was going to pound me into the sand. And what he really seemed to be doing is he'd feel a bubble or two. He'd look back to see what you were doing and continue on singing. Not frightened, but curious with what was going on. And but that noise was so loud. Still, I my hearing gets more interesting every year, and I like to blame it on singing whales rather than outboard motors.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. My guest this hour is Flip Nicklin. His new book is called Among Giants: A Life with Whales. Let's go on the phones now to Will in Dallas. Hi, Will.
Hey, hi. Thank you. I was wondering if Mr. Nicklin has any opinion on the TV show Whale Wars. And if it's doing any good or any harm, or you know, just a general idea of his opinion of the program.
I'm not familiar with that show. Do you know it, Flip?
Whale Wars.
Oh, I do, certainly. And I would lump any of the sort of Hollywood or TV versions of things that may use a bit of poetic license to make their story more interesting as great to get you interested in the subjects.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a beginning point, not an end point. And as you look in, you find out all of these complex questions are much more interesting and have many more issues and sides than we might think. My grandfather used to say that life was a game of chess where people think they're playing checkers. And I think this is that situation. If you look into the issues of whaling and who whales and how they whale and what the issues are, and on the Internet you can get lots of different information. Whale Wars, if they get you interested in what the situations are, they've done a good job. But they're not the end of the whole thing.
It is interesting in Western culture, you know, you have the sort of Herman Melville vision of this great white beast that is so dangerous and malevolent. And then on the other hand, we have, and I know that you've done some work with SeaWorld, but we've got the Shamu phenomenon, both of which are sound like it's the sort of same thing you're talking about. They're very black and white as opposed to being more nuanced. Which do you think is potentially more problematic?
All of the above.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a great job. I'm a journalist. I worked for National Geographic for most of my work. And when we did killer whales in 1984, it was to say they weren't all mindless killers.
Mm-hmm.
When I did killer whales in 2005, it was to say they weren't all free willy. and so my idea was to keep people thinking and give people things to think about, but not tell them exactly what to think.
Yeah. And it seems like people are able to make up their minds if you give them enough information.
I think there's a hunger for the gray areas, you
mm-hmm.
know, and I mean, we hunt whales. The U.S. is a whale hunting nation. We're part of that whole thing. And we have a rhetoric that works for us. And I've worked with people who are whale hunters in a number of parts of the world. Most of them are decent human beings with different cultures.
Mm-hmm. You say the U.S. is a whale hunting nation. Is this mostly native peoples who are hunting whales, or is there a commercial whaling industry still?
No, well, primarily, no, it's indigenous whaling from the Inupiat in northern Alaska, and then still in the books with just a few whales taken, just one or two, are the Macaw people in the Olympic Peninsula of Washington hunting gray whales.
Mm-hmm.
But we are, when we fight for indigenous whaling rights in the IWC and... And it is, I mean, I think it's an important part of the culture, but it is also something that makes international whale law very complex.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. My guest this hour, Flip Nicklin. His new book is called Among Giants, A Life with Whales. Let's go next to Carlos in Dallas. Hi, Carlos.
Hi. I'm going to Argentina, Peninsula Valdez, in September, and it's the first time I'm going to be seeing whales. Any advice for me to do?
It's a wonderful place. I was there last October. That was where we did the first wild whale story my father did for Geographic in 1972. When I was there in October, we went out just on a regular commercial. I'm doing more taking people through National Geographic expeditions out to look at whales in the Antarctic or Mexico or Alaska. So we had a group of people touring and wanted to see whales. We were taking pictures of whales before the boat was launched. There were so many whales, and they were so easy to work with. It was a wonderful place, and fall is the right time to be there.
Are whales like a lot of other animals that encounter human beings? If they see enough of them, they become less sort of threatened by the presence of people around and boats and things?
Oh, certainly. I think they habituate, and there have been some really interesting things. Gray whales that were hunted so hard in the lagoons of Baja California, sometime in the mid to late 70s, females started bringing their calves up to small boats. And now in the middle of the season, it's fairly routine for a mother to push the baby up next to the boat and have the baby looking in the boat. And that's a new behavior, but great if you're a whale watcher and want to get an up-close look.
So what kind of education do we know that mother whales give their calves before they sort of let them out on their own?
Again, it depends on which whales, which places. If you have sperm whales or killer whales, then they live with their family for sometimes life. If you're talking about a humpback whale or the big mysticetes, blue whales and such, they're just with their young for 1 year. And so they, at least with humpback whales, which I know the most about, it looks like they give them sort of a grand tour, and then the young animal is off on its own. But humpbacks seem to do very well with sharing information for non-kin members, which makes them very interesting.
I had to laugh because I was sort of ashamed at looking at some of the pictures of humpback whales in the book and noticing that they look a little bit like gigantic blue pickles. And then you tell the story of a photo editor at National Geographic making the same observation, so I felt better.
Kathy Moran, her first thing was, I was asked, trying to get a film review on how I was doing. Well, the pictures are fine, but they look very Gherkin-esque.
What does it take to work with photo editors, and you have the entire experience, and you sort of know what you really want, and then you have someone coming in and saying, well, this will work for this reason or not. Talk a little bit about that relationship.
Oh, I think photo editors, illustrations editors are called at the Geographic, are really important. It's easy to fall in love with work that you worked very hard to get, mm-hmm. and sometimes dismiss things that you caught just as a grab shot. To have someone with a fresh eye look at that, and actually Kathy Moran, who is the senior natural history editor at Geographic now, edited Among Giants also, and we worked on many stories together. Having someone like that who has a good knowledge and interest, but a little more objective eye is really an important thing.
It's got to be hard enough to choose from decades of pictures that you've made, but how do you, to put inside the book, but how did you decide on what would be on the cover?
I let someone else do it. It came down to, I think I cut down to about 600 pictures shot over 30-something years. Kathy Moran and Lisa Litton, who designed the book, worked together and got it down to half a dozen pictures to think about. And then at that point, it wouldn't have been my first choice, but I've grown to love it.
Just about everybody in your line of work, shooting things in nature, dreams of working for National Geographic. And for you, it was not certainly an overnight road. Can you talk about your first meeting with Bob Gilka in 1978?
Well, I wanted, ever since I met Bates Little Hales as a teenager, I dreamed of it. It didn't seem very realistic. I taught a bunch of National Geographic photographers how to scuba dive at our dive shop in San Diego. And I had managed to get a couple pictures published, and I worked as an assistant and got two pictures shot on that story published. So I conned my way into going back to Washington, D.C., and Bates, who was a longtime staff photographer there, invited me in and was going to introduce me to Bob Gilka. I had hundreds of pictures from the shots I'd done in the Northwest Pacific Islands and Hawaii on a light table, and as I heard them coming to the door, I turned around and knocked all the pictures on the floor. These are slides. So I'm on my hands and knees trying to pick up pictures, and I see these shoes come in and hear Gilka say, he had a very gruff voice. I mean, he's a wonderful guy, and but a very gruff voice, saying, I see you're busy, I'll talk to you later. And I just sure it was done right then.
I know it's also been really important to you over the years to sort of shepherd other photographers. We had Paul Nicklin, who is not related to you, but who apparently contacted you and said, can I tell people I'm your nephew? talk about, you know, your relationship with him and with other people who are trying to learn this incredibly complex set of skills that you have.
Well, certainly I'm very proud of Paul, and that's a true story. Through a mutual friend in the high Arctic, he asked if he could say he was related. I said, fine. And then everywhere I went, I heard that Paul had been there. I met him doing a polar bear story for Geographic in the late 90s, and he helped me a lot on that story. And he knew all about photography and all about cameras. He didn't know journalism very much, so I brought him and his wife in for a couple of years to live with me and get a start. And a lot of it was editing and presentation and how to work with Geographic. And he's gone on to be a tremendous force with a great passion for what he's doing. I'm now working with a videographer named Jason Sturgis, who, God, we've been working for almost 10 years, and he's doing wonderful stuff. And he will very much take over what I've been doing, telling the story of research with humpback whales in Hawaii. I talked to him earlier today, and great guy, great freediver. I mean, he freedives depths I don't even dream of, and he'll be the kind of guy that you build the future on.
It's got to be nice today that no matter where in the world your protégés are, you can instantly sort of get an update on what they're doing thanks to the Internet.
Isn't that great? We've done so much stuff. University of Chicago Press suggested that I get on Facebook to promote the book, and I wasn't sure about that. I've had great fun, and actually we just did a presentation in New York at the Explorers Club, and my date from the senior prom showed up with her adult son. It was great fun. I mean, that kind of connecting has been a great side benefit.
Flip Nicklin is my guest. He's lead whale photographer and marine mammal specialist for the National Geographic Society. His new book is called Among Giants, A Life with Whales. We'll take more of your calls after this break. The telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a self-designed graduate program that allows you the chance to meet the challenges of society. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Charles Flip Nicklin, lead whale photographer and marine mammal specialist for National Geographic. His new book is called Among Giants, A Life with Whales. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org. Flip, since we're talking about technology, your publicist sent us a beautiful hardcover copy of the book so I could prepare for this interview, and I was very thankful. But I have to tell you, when I found out there is an iPad edition, it occurred to me that the kind of work that you do and the kind of technology that is available now on tablet computers seems like the perfect synthesis.
I think so. It was a new idea for me, but it looks great. And the idea that I can incorporate some of Jason Sturgis's video and some whale sound with it, I think it's a wonderful. I got an iPad, that was my excuse, and I've fallen in love with it.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go to Barbara in Dallas. Hi, Barbara.
Hi. I'm interested in the type of camera equipment you use when freediving, and if applicable, how has digital changed how you freedive and instantly see what you've captured?
Well, I'm using a Nikon D3 and a CNC housing, which is a fairly good-sized underwater still camera, but now the new version also has high-definition video, which will be great fun. I started shooting digital in 2003. I shot for 2 weeks, came back to my home in Juneau, Alaska, took all my film cameras to the local camera store and said, sell them for whatever you can get.
No kidding.
The idea of being able to see where you're at, and they've become so good. And I only had 36 frames in with film, so you can only shoot a few pictures before you had to go back and change film or change cameras.
Oh, sure, because you've got to return to the surface to
exactly.
switch out that roll.
The first time I shot a singer with digital, I could look at the pictures as I swam back to the surface.
Huh.
So, no, it changed everything, and I would never go back.
And you have had the heartbreaking experience. It's sort of like the photographer's equivalent of the one that got away, right? You've had your cameras flood?
Oh, I've had cameras flood. I think we were talking in the book. No one had taken a picture of a bowhead whale underwater in the high Arctic, and I finally got the message that my Inuit guide was trying to tell me there was one close, but he was so polite it took a while for me to figure it out. I raced down and found there was a small bowhead next to the ice with a bunch of belugas swimming around him. Jumped in the water. It was a great situation. I shot 36 frames and found out there'd just been a drop of condensation that had frozen the shutter. So nothing came out. And I actually did get the first picture of a bowhead, but it was a number of years later.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Nelson in Dallas. Hey, Nelson.
Yeah, hi. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, hi. I have a question. I was watching maybe a year ago a documentary on a humpback whale that had a very young offspring. I think it was off the coast of Mexico, possibly. And it was attacked, the offspring, by a group of killer whales. And all they ended up at the end, they killed the offspring, but all they ate was the jaw of the offspring. And I've been very curious if anyone would know why that was and why that happened. And I'll just listen off the air.
Sure. One of the things is a lot of times when killer whales are going after a large whale in deep water off Monterey or somewhere, they just take the richest pieces, the fattiest pieces that are the most energy for them, and the rest sinks away. But there's new science that'll come out about a place called False Pass, which is the first opening from the Pacific into the Bering Sea through the Aleutians. And that's a place where killer whales go after usually gray whale offspring, and it's shallow water. And in a place like that, they return numerous times. And not only are they getting more out of it, but the bits and pieces get spread out, and brown bears and eagles and foxes also get part of the take.
Have there always been humpback whales in Hawaii?
Maybe not. There weren't as many as there are now. There was never any whaling in Hawaii. The whalers went there to provision, but they were actually whaling either in the Japan grounds for sperm whales or in the Arctic for bowheads and right whales. But when they came back in the winter, they made all kinds of notes about turtles and seals and stuff, but not about singing humpback whales. The first story about humpback whales in Hawaii was in a surfer magazine that we could find.
Wow.
It was in a surf magazine in the 60s. And whether they were driven off the coast when industrial whaling started in the late 1800s or whatever, but it seems there's no big history about them. There's a theory that they weren't there until fairly recently.
So populations of different kinds of whales maybe are always moving to different locations?
It certainly has happened. For instance, gray whales coming down the coast used to hug the shore by Long Beach and the areas around Los Angeles. And since there's been increases in activity, they're more going on the outside of the Channel Islands. So I think they certainly do adapt.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we will speak with Patrick in Dallas. Hi, Patrick.
Hey, how you doing?
Great, thanks.
Hey, I wanted to ask you a question. My great uncle was Luis Martin, and I know he worked for National Geographic for many years. And unfortunately, I was really young when I knew him, and I didn't get to ask him near as many questions as I wanted to. But did you ever have a chance to work with him?
I never worked with Louis Martin. I certainly met him and worked on some stories that he was on as a writer. He and his wife Ethel going off and doing adventures. He's certainly one of the legends of National Geographic, and he preceded Bates Littlehales as the underwater guy, doing the Wreck of the Bounty and stories like that. And no, he was certainly when you talk about those great characters from the founding days, Louis Martin is one of those guys.
So your wife is a scientist, and you met on a National Geographic-sponsored cruise, but she thought at the time she wanted nothing to do with a photographer?
She had her ideas. But it worked out. After 3 days, I knew we liked each other because she told me, and it's worked out very well ever since.
So how much of your sort of over-the-dinner-table conversation has to do with marine biology?
Well, in Hawaii, probably every night.
Mm-hmm.
But Linda has also written two books for National Geographic Children called Face to Face with Whales and Face to Face with Dolphins, and is working on another one right now. So she's sort of the same species, and though she's worrying this evening what shoes she'll wear to the gala, she's pretty much a field person and has much better bear stories than I do.
1-800-933-5372. We'll go back to the phones now. This time we'll speak with Richard in Dallas. Hi, Richard.
Hi, thanks for having me on the show.
Sure.
I know you touched on this briefly, but I was curious if you could touch on that length. The trend of whaling, and do you see that increasing, decreasing, remaining the same, and the impact it could potentially have on the whale population where whaling is permitted?
Well, I think that's a very good question. What will happen with whaling? We're still in a moratorium that started in the mid-'80s. But there are a number of things. Indigenous whaling is allowed. Scientific whaling, which is what the Japanese call their whaling in the Antarctic, is allowed. So there is still some taking of whales. That's being discussed right now of changing it around and changing the wording and the labels. Whaling right now is primarily for food. There's no whaling like the industrial whaling when we were using them for munitions and margarine and things. It's probably not the big issue right now. Whaling is always going to be a very emotional subject and hard to see an animal we love taken. I'd love for whales to be treated as a special category. But threats to the habitat, how we're going to deal with whales as they recover, how we're going to share resources with them, are probably even bigger issues than whaling itself.
What impact have you seen directly on the whale population of global warming?
You know, I don't know. It is one of the things. It's opened up the top of the area north of Alaska in the Arctic and makes some joining of whale populations possible. What it's going to do with food is probably the biggest thing. And I'll go with climate change because that's probably the more important thing. For a couple of years recently, we've had really bad ice in the Bering Sea, interfering with where gray whales feed, that seems to have reduced the number of calves they've had.
Mm-hmm.
But they've seemed to make some adjustments, and they had a great year for calves this year. But I think they are going through some things, and as their habitat changes, the flexible whales do fairly well. Some whales, like humpbacks and gray whales, are much more flexible than others, and they'll have to make the adjustments if they're going to succeed, just like we will.
How big is a gray whale calf at birth?
Oh, I don't know, 8 or 10 feet, I guess.
So they've got huge appetites.
They're much bigger when they're up close than when you see them next to mom.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we'll speak with Mark in Dallas. Hey, Mark.
Hey there. Good evening. Good afternoon. Pardon me. A guy that I went to high school was an equipment wrangler, dive master on the Cove, the movie about the dolphins and the slaughter they have over there. And I was wondering if you had any contact with any of those people or any information or insight on that particular production.
This is the film about Japanese whaling, is that right?
Oh, sure. It's a film about Taiji, yes. Well, Luis Hoyas was a very, very good National Geographic photographer, did a number of stories on things like dinosaurs, and actually Louis came to us to talk about what subjects he might do his story on early on, and we looked at humpbacks, and I think he picked a great subject to focus on. I think that's another one of those stories that has had a great emotional grab on people and gets them interested, and hopefully they'll use that interest to get a bigger view of what's happening, not just in Japan, but worldwide with dolphins.
It's very clear, Flip, in having this conversation with you and certainly in reading the things you write in the book, that you have great respect not only for the scientists who are doing this work but for other photographers. I'm curious, though, when somebody sends back really a remarkable photograph, whether for National Geographic or somewhere else. Do you look at that? Are you more likely to envy having made the picture itself or the experience that the photographer had creating it?
Oh, the experience. Mm-hmm. It is. We've had first time I went to one of the National Geographic photo seminars that they have early in the year. I remember being sort of overloaded and walking out, and I wasn't sure whether to go out and start shooting a news story today or give all my cameras away. But now I think that the new ideas that come through, it's always a mix. You always want to have seen that thing and haven't taken that picture, but also you're getting new ideas and new ways to say things.
How much can you manipulate the controls on your camera when it is in a housing?
It depends on the housing. The one I use, I have very, very good control. And certainly I'm so much further ahead. The old housings when I started were sort of starter kits, and they never quite worked. And they might not work with one type of camera, but one camera. And if that camera got broke, you had to find a new one that was just like it. And it was a really different thing. But I have very good control. And autofocus and the latitude that you have with digital, I used to think I would get one picture out of three. Now, if I have a chance, I usually get it.
So when you are taking photographs, is there something? I know that you always want to get something new, but what makes a really spectacular photograph?
Well, there are two things. One is something new, mm-hmm. and the other thing is something that's not new in such a different way that it's new again. But if you're not doing one of those two things, you're not going to go very far, at least for telling stories for National Geographic.
That's got to be hard after you have been working for so long and you have a style to challenge yourself within your own style to still get something different.
Well, the great thing for me doing covering whales is the researchers would keep going out there. So when I did sperm whales in the mid-'80s, I got four rolls of film with not much in it, but it was all new in 1984. In 1995, those same guys had another decade of work, and I got more great stuff in the first 3 days than I did in those 6 months because they had learned so much more. They had so many new things to show me.
What does it take to develop the kind of patience you need to do your work?
I'm sorry?
How did you develop the patience that you need to some days get a bunch of great stuff and other times have weeks go by before you have a picture that you really love?
I don't know. I think I used to go as a kid from the dive shop 5 miles to La Jolla and jump in with a spear gun and go looking to spear a fish.
Mm-hmm.
And early on was trained that you wanted to get the right kind of fish, and it was better to come back with nothing than to shoot something you really didn't want. And doing that day after day and only getting a fish once in a while probably was the starting ground for being patient in what I was after.
Charles Flip Nicklin is lead whale photographer and marine mammal specialist for the National Geographic Society. His new book is called Among Giants, A Life with Whales. Flip, it's been such a pleasure to have you on. Thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
It was my pleasure. Thank you very much.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think production team includes engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.